Hello, and welcome to episode 72 of the Story Hack Podcast. The Story Hack Podcast features action, adventure, and mystery stories, mostly from the public domain. Story Hack is also a print magazine which publishes new action and adventure stories in a wide variety of genres. Visit storyhack.com today for more information. Today, we will hear part 6 of Wanderers of the Wolf Moon by Nelson S. Bond.
Chapter 6. The others were awake now. Young Tommy was awake with excitement. He made a headlong dash for the dry niche wherein were stored the arms of the cave dwellers, came back dragging 3 rifles, handed one to Greg and another to Hannigan. "Let's get going, Greg," he yelped. "Golly Moses, what do you think it is? Animals, maybe, or people? Gosh, let's get going." Greg took the spare rifle from him firmly. "We'll go, you stay." Then, in swift contrition as the lad's face fell measurable inches. "Someone must guard the cave while we're gone, Tommy. Tina, build up the fire and put a kettle on." "Aunt Maud," the old woman nodded grimly. "I know, we'll have hot water ready, and bandages if you need 'em. Run along." How they ever got down that mountainside so quickly was ever afterward a mystery to Greg. It was not exactly a painless descent. Their progress was a series of runs, falls, and buttock-bruising slides, yet the footing in broad daylight was precarious at best. With only sallow Saturn and the aura of the rings to illumine their way, it is a wonder they ever reached the plain whole in a single piece. To add to their frenetic haste, in their ears there rang the constant challenge of gunfire. Crimson flashes lit the flatsward below. Once a whining slug, miserably aimed, made both of them duck instinctively as it shrilled somewhere over their heads, spanged. Against a rock behind them, went ricocheting off into the darkness. For now they were on level ground, and mingled with the rattle of arms there was another sound, the purling whimper of tongueless, inhuman things astir and hungry. Greg had once heard, on Earth, the furtive night passage of a jackal tribe, the soft, half-plaintive mewlings, the incessant scrape of scrabbling paws, the ammoniac stench of unwashed bodies. He thought of this now, sharply, as he heard these mutterings, smelled these rank odors, strained his eyes to determine contours in the darkling night. Hannigan complained, "You see, M, Greg, it's dark as a whale's gut. I can't see nothing. What'll we fire at? Are our folks out in the open or in the skiff? We might hit them if," Greg said. "We'll know in a minute." As they moved forward, he tugged from his belt the weapon he had been holding in reserve, the one such weapon found amongst the stores of the life skiff, one he dared use but infrequently because once its charge was exhausted, he had no way of replenishing it. "We should be near enough now. Spot M quick and fire while there's light." He jerked the trigger of the Heimholst flame pistol. A writhing streamer of ochre speared from its muzzle, lighting the plain with a hot and eerie effulgence. Like a fiery dart, it blazed into the heart of the pack surrounding the life skiff. By its lingering gleam, Greg saw, with stomach-churning repulsion, the creatures which attacked. Neither men nor wolves were they, but a cruel parody on each. Lean, hair-matted beast-things running on 4 legs, semi-human of feature, but with loose lips snarling back from yellow fangs, fingered paws long-clawed, indescribably evil and filthy, the more inhuman because they embodied so many physical attributes of man. Their pack must have numbered 60, ranging from gray-pelted old ones to skinny, ragged pups. Apparently they had surprised the plateau party in the open, allowing them no time to remove their precious camp stuffs, because the ground about, around and before the skiff, was littered with a refuse of clothing, blankets, supplies and equipment, cases and scraps of food. It was for this last that the wolfmen had attacked, because even as the ochre beam found their midst, they were scrambling hungrily about the campsite, avidly gobbling all edible scraps they could nose out. A few more aggressive ones scented richer victuals. These it was who, despite the sporadic fire from within the skiff, snuffled, clawed, and clamored at the port, until the heat beam struck them. That put an end to their hunger and their bloodlust. Like any wild woodland animal, they had no fear of firearms. They had no experience with them. Bullets that struck killed. Wolfmen untouched by bullets had no way of associating hurt with a sharp burst of sound and a strange, unfamiliar powder scent. But light, light that burned the hair and scorched the flesh. Light that spared not one of them but spread to doze all with its heatful pain, that was something different. As the beam struck and spread, snuffings changed to bestial screams of fear and pain. Those nearest the beam's focal point felt no pain. They died instantly, charred hulks that crisped and sank, shapeless, to the ground. And from these strangely altered, swiftly dead companions, the others fled, howling in shrill alarm. Their footsteps were the dry patter of leaves on shale. They broke and ran wildly for the nether hills, tonguing shrill ululations of hurt. Then the door of the skiff opened cautiously. Dim light was a sliver, a crack, an oblong, and the voice of J. Foster Andrews quavered through the darkness to their ears. It sounded shrill and afraid. "Malcolm, is that you?" Sparks snorted derisively. "Ain't that awful?" he demanded. "Is that you?" he raised his voice. "Hell no, it ain't him. It's the Gray Lensman. Who'd you think?" "Shut up, Sparks," Greg said. "Hold your fire. The wolf things are gone. We're coming in." A few moments later, he and Hannigan were standing within the life skiff. Gregory Malcolm was 26 years old. For more than 8 years, he had been training himself to undergo any and all emotions without change of expression. That was, in his opinion, a prime requisite for a man whose vocation lay in a subordinate position. Now he was grateful for learning that self-control, and hoped his features were as granite-like as he tried to make them. He hoped his eyes did not mirror the astonishment, the shock, the numb dismay he felt when he first glanced about the interior of that cabin, and at those who stood before him. It was incredible that in one short week, one very short Titanian week, so great a change could have been wrought in this haughty quintet. His followers were weathering the storm of catastrophe without faltering, without any relaxation of civilized standards, but Bredons, he studied them, his quietude concealing the sudden heartsickness he knew, his spectacles hiding the swift light of horror in his eyes. The men had not shaved. It was clear since their crash landing. 5-day stubble lay frostily on the jowls of Jay, Foster Andrews, blackly on the cheeks of his son and son-in-law-to-be. Nor did slovenliness end there. Beneath the beard growth, the skin of the men looked dirty, dingy, sallow, as if they had not washed for days. Their clothes were equally soiled and sorry. Greg saw that Jay, Foster's nails were dull and broken and grubby as the nails of a stevedore. He rallied himself with an effort. These were men. They had been working hard, laboring. They could not stay immaculate. They had been in a fight. Then he looked at the women and knew that he made excuses vainly. It was even more disillusioning to see what had happened to Mrs. Andrews and Crystal in so short a time. Enid Andrews, fashion plate of two continents, one of Earth's smartest-dressed women, thrice named by fashion authorities as best-dressed woman in the Solar Confederation, hobbled sloppily about on scuffed slippers, the heel of one of which had broken off and not been replaced, so that her posture sagged like a bag of meal, split at a side seam and sifting awkwardly away. Her once elaborate coiffure was a bird's nest of tangled braids which hung unbraided, curls that sagged limply. Hastily adjusted pins and combs clung insecurely to locks that, once pearl silver, were now clay-crusted gray. Crystal, glamorous, pulse-stirring Crystal, was in no better plight. Her gorgeous ash-gold hair was pulled severely back from a forehead which, Greg discovered, was not nearly so broad and smooth and high as he had imagined. The artificial color had rubbed from her cheeks, leaving them lusterless and sullen. Her lips, ever rich, ripe, full, were pale and harsh-thin, and her mouth had tight, argumentative lines at the corners. Her eyes were dark-rimmed, weary, haggard. She was, thought Greg with shocked comprehension, a tired girl. They were all tired. Tired and beaten and dejected, all but Bredon, who even now was eyeing Greg defiantly, as if challenging him to comment on their condition. He said, bitterly, "Thank you, Malcolm. It was a most magnanimous gesture, coming down from your hilltop castle to rescue us." Greg said nothing. He was looking about the interior of the cabin, noticing with incredulous disfavor the way it had been abused, littered, left uncleaned. Ashes, dirty dishes, scraps of cloth and paper, fragments of cartons and dirt tracked in from outside. But Hannigan was not bound by Greg's compunctions. He spoke his mind frankly, staring at the 5 skiff dwellers with obvious contempt in his eyes. "If you'd ask me," he said, "it's damn near time. Somebody come down and rescued you. Not from wolves, neither, from yourselves. You all look like you'd been drugged through the butt end of a ringer." "Well, we have," began Bert Andrews savagely. "We have been through—" "Shut up, you fool." Bredon cut short his plaint viciously, blustered defiance that was in itself an apology. "We've been busy making a camp around here. We haven't had time to," Sparks drawled. "Bud, we've been busy making a camp, too, in a place which wasn't already equipped with furnishings like yourn. And I think we've done a better job of it. And in between times, we found time to shave and bathe once in a while." Andrews flushed and said stiffly, "There is a need of being provident with water. Our supply is limited," Greg said. "What? You mean you've been using the water reserve from the life skiff?" Enid Andrews answered, excitedly, volubly, almost at the point of tears. She wrung her hands, and Greg could not help noticing the anomaly of those at once dirty and gem-bedecked fingers. "We have. Oh, we have. There's no other water anywhere around here, nor food. We've been living on concentrates, sickening, horrible stuff." "That's not true," flamed Bredon. "We did have other food. I made bread. I caught small game. I put out traps. There would have been plenty of food except for the wolfmen who raided tonight. They broke our stove, stole my reserves," which, mocked Sparks, "you conveniently left out for them to sniff and come a-running after. Why don't you call it a day, Bredon? Admit you're nothing but a cocky earthlubber at heart and, why, you little whippersnapper." Bredon took a swift step forward, but Greg had heard enough. He laid a restraining hand on the socialite's arm. His voice was as soothing, as pleading as he could make it. "Haven't we had enough of that already? Look here, Bredon. Let's let bygones be bygones. We've had our little quarrel, now let's act like sane and sensible humans. You're not situated here any too well. You've admitted you're not near a water supply. The terrain is open to attack, as is proven by tonight's incident. You've been, well, let's say unlucky. On the other hand, we've been lucky. We've got a nice, warm cave large enough to house all 10 of us easily. We have soft beds and good food and fresh milk, safety and good fellowship. With some of the things you have in here, those upholstered chairs, for instance, what remains of your equipment and supplies, we could make a veritable paradise of our cave. So what do you say? Let's cast in our lots together, make it one big happy family." Jay Foster looked at him thoughtfully. Enid Andrews began to cry softly. Crystal glanced at Ralph, then at Greg, then at Bredon again. Bert Andrews stroked his chin. He said, "It sounds good," Bredon interrupted. "There's just one thing, Malcolm," he said curtly. "We'll accept your overtures of friendship on one condition, that you'll step down from the high horse you've been riding lately, come to the realization that you're not cock-o'-the-walk around these parts." Greg said gravely, "If you mean that our community shall be a society in which all share and share alike, I am in complete agreement with you." "That's what I mean," said Bredon. "Of course, we all recognize that there must be leadership. As our oldest man, our most important member, Mr. Andrews, is that logical leader. I can assure you, acting as his lieutenant." "No," said Sparks loudly. "It's the same old thing in a different package, Greg. He wants to be boss, else he won't play. The answer is comets to you, Bredon. We're doing all right the way we are. You're making a mess of your affairs. As far as I'm concerned, you can stay here and stew in your own gravy." He turned toward the door. Greg said, "Wait, Sparks, I'll be right with you." And he, too, nodded at Bredon. "I fear Sparks is right, Bredon. You haven't learned your lesson yet. We're going back where we belong. We're glad to have been of some small service to you. If you ever need us again, just call. Meanwhile, my offer remains open. If you should ever decide to join us on our terms..." A loud and cheerful voice interrupted him. A voice from outside, bellowing gay greeting, "Ahoy, you in there. Open the door." Sparks said, "Aunt Maud, what's she?" And pulled the door open. In the oblong against the slow gray dawn now crawling above the hilltop stood Aunt Maud, a huge grin on her face, a tremendous bowl in her stalwart arms. From the bowl rose a tantalizing aroma. She waddled in, plunked it on the nearest desk. "Thought you folks might be sort of hungry after a scrap," she grinned. "Watched it from the cave. Nice cozy place to watch a fight from. Saw morning was coming on, so I brought you down some breakfast." "Sister," she glanced at the sallow-cheeked Enid shrewdly, "you look sort of peaked. You too, Crystal, you look older, honey. Well, Greg, ready, we'd better be running along. Tina's got our breakfast almost ready. Fruit juice and porridge and pancakes with butter and sugar syrup. Sounds good, eh? Well, bye, folks." And by main force, she herded the two men swiftly out of the skiff. Outside, moving toward the hill, Sparks turned on her pettishly. "Now, what did you go and do that for, Aunt Maud? You've gummed up everything. Greg was telling him off, just beginning to make him listen to reason." Aunt Maud grinned and winked broadly at Greg. Sparks, are all radio men as dumb as you, or do you hold the championship? Greg could talk from now to doomsday and not get anywhere with that outfit. I know. They're my own haughty, independent, pig-headed flesh and blood. But that stew I brought them, she chuckled and rolled her eyes delightedly. Now that's a real argument, the best their bellies ever listened to. Just wait and see.
This is the end of episode 72. Thank you for listening. If you want to support the podcast, please visit storyhack.com and check out issues of the magazine or our other anthology publications. You'll be glad you did.